To 7 levels up, he said. To heaven. Hearing the familiar idea of 7 levels, I asked him if he meant that his meditation took him up through the 7 sacred chakras of the body, which are discussed in yoga. Not chakras, he said. Places. This meditation takes me 7 places in universe, up and up. Last place I go is heaven. I asked, have you been to heaven, Katut? He smiled. Of course he had been there, he said. Easy to go to heaven. What's it like? I asked. Beautiful. Everything beautiful is there. Every person beautiful is there. Everything beautiful to eat is there. Everything is love there. Heaven is love. Then Katut said he knows another meditation, to down. This down meditation takes him 7 levels below the world. This is a more dangerous meditation, not for beginning people, only for a master. So I asked, if you go up to heaven in the first meditation, then in the second meditation you must go down to hell, he finished the statement. This was interesting. Heaven and hell aren't ideas I've heard discussed very much in Hinduism. Hindus see the universe in terms of karma, a process of constant circulation, which is to say that you don't really end up anywhere at the end of your life, not in heaven or hell, but just get recycled back to the earth again in another form, in order to resolve whatever relationships or mistakes you left uncompleted last time. When you finally achieve perfection, you graduate out of the cycle entirely and melt into the void. The notion of karma implies that heaven and hell are only to be found here on earth, where we have the capacity to create them, manufacturing either goodness or evil, depending on our destinies and our characters. Karma is a notion I've always liked. Not so much literally, not necessarily because I believe that I used to be Cleopatra's bartender, but more metaphorically. The karmic philosophy appeals to me on a metaphorical level because even in one lifetime, it's obvious how often we must repeat our same mistakes, banging our heads against the same old addictions and compulsions, generating the same old miserable and often catastrophic consequences until finally we stop and fix it. This is the supreme lesson of karma, and also of Western psychology, by the way. Take care of the problems now, or else you'll just have to suffer again later when you screw everything up the next time. And that repetition of suffering, that's hell. Moving out of that endless repetition to a new level of understanding, there's where you'll find heaven. But here, Katut was talking about heaven and hell in a different way, as if they are real places in the universe which he has actually visited. At least I think that's what he meant. Trying to get clear on this, I asked, "You have been to hell, Katut?" He smiled. Of course he's been there. What's it like in hell? Same like heaven, he said. He saw my confusion and tried to explain. Universe is circle-less. I still wasn't sure I understood. He said, to up, to down, all same at end. I remembered an old Christian mystic notion, as above, so below. I asked, then how can you tell the difference between heaven and hell? Because of how you go. Heaven, you go up through 7 happy places. Hell, you go down through 7 sad places. This is why it better for you to go up, Liz, he laughed. I asked, you mean you might as well spend your life going upward through the happy places, since heaven and hell, the destinations, are the same thing anyway? Same, same, he said. Same in end. So, better to be happy on journey. I said, so if heaven is love, then hell is love too, he said. I sat with that one for a while, trying to make the math work. Katut laughed again, slapped my knee affectionately with his hand. Always so difficult for a young person to understand this. 88. So I was hanging out in YN's shop again this morning, and she was trying to figure out how to make my hair grow faster and thicker. Having glorious, thick, shiny hair herself that hangs all the way down to her butt, she feels sorry for me with my wispy blonde mop. As a healer, of course, she does have a remedy to help thicken my hair, but it won't be easy. First, I have to find a banana tree and personally cut it down. I have to throw away the top of the tree, then carve the trunk and roots, which are still lodged in the earth, into a big, deep bowl, like a swimming pool. Then I have to put a piece of wood over the top of this hollow so rainwater and dew don't get in. Then I will come back in a few days and find that the swimming pool is now filled with nutrient-rich liquid of the banana root, which I must then collect in bottles and bring to Wyan. She will bless the banana root juice at the temple and then rub the juice into my skull every day. Within a few months, I will have, like Wyan, thick, shiny hair all the way down to my butt. Even if you are bald, she said, this will make you have hair. As we're talking, little Tuti, just home from school, is sitting on the floor drawing a picture of a house. Mostly, houses are what Tuti draws these days. She's dying to have a house of her own. There's always a rainbow in the backdrop of her pictures, and a smiling family, father and all. This is what we do all day in Wyan's shop. We sit and talk, and Tuti draws pictures, and Wyan and I gossip and tease each other. Wyan's got a bawdy sense of humor, always talking about sex, busting me about being single, speculating on the genital endowments of all the men who pass by her shop. She keeps telling me she's going to the temple every evening and praying for a good man to show up in my life, to be my lover. I told her again this morning, no, Wyan, I don't need it. My heart's been broken too many times. She said, I know cure for broken heart. Authoritatively and in a doctorly manner, Wyan ticked off on her fingers the six elements of her fail-proof broken heart curing treatment. Vitamin E, get much sleep, drink much water, travel to a place far away from the person you loved, meditate, and teach your heart that this is destiny. I've been doing everything but the vitamin E, I said. So, now you're cured, and you need a new man. I bring you one from praying. Well, I'm not praying for a new man, Wyan. The only thing I'm praying for these days is to have peace with myself. Wyan rolled her eyes like, yeah, right, whatever you claim, you big white weirdo, and said, that's because you have bad memory problem. You don't remember anymore how nice is sex. I used to have bad memory problem, too, when I was married. Every time I saw a handsome man walking down the street, I would forget I had a husband back home. She nearly fell over laughing. Then she composed herself and concluded, everybody needs sex, Liz. At this moment, a great-looking woman came walking into the shop, smiling like a lighthouse beam. Tuti leapt up and ran into her arms, shouting, Armenia! 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 Which, as it turned out, was the woman's name, not some kind of strange nationalistic battle cry. I introduced myself to Armenia, and she told me she was from Brazil. She was so dynamic, this woman, so Brazilian. She was gorgeous, elegantly dressed, charismatic and engaging, and indeterminate in age, just insistently sexy. Armenia, too, is a friend of Wyan's, who comes to the shop frequently for lunch and for various traditional medical and beauty treatments. She sat down and talked with us for about an hour, joining our gossipy, girlish little circle. She's in Bali for only another week before she has to fly off to Africa, or maybe it's back to Thailand, to take care of her business. This Armenia woman, it turns out, has had just the teensiest bit of a glamorous life. She used to work for the United Nations High Commissioner on Refugees. Back in the 1980s, she had been sent into the El Salvadoran and Nicaraguan jungles during the height of war as a negotiator of peace, using her beauty and charm and wits to get all the generals and rebels to calm down and listen to reason. Hello, pretty power. Now she runs a multinational marketing business called Novica, which supports indigenous artists all over the world by selling their products on the internet. She speaks about 7 or 8 languages. She's got the most fabulous pair of shoes I've seen since Rome. Looking at us both, Wyan said, Liz, why you never tried to look sexy like Armenia? You're such a pretty girl. You have good capital of nice face, nice body, nice smile, but always you wear the same broken T-shirt, same broken jeans. Don't you want to be sexy like her? Wyan, I said, Armenia is Brazilian. It's a completely different situation. How is it different? Armenia, I said, turning to my new friend, can you please try to explain to Wyan what it means to be a Brazilian woman? Armenia laughed, but then seemed to consider the question seriously, and answered, well, I always try to look nice and be feminine even in the war zones and refugee camps of Central America. Even in the worst tragedies and crises, There's no reason to add to everybody's misery by looking miserable yourself. That's my philosophy. That's why I always wore makeup and jewelry into the jungle. Nothing too extravagant, but maybe just a nice gold bracelet and some earrings, a little lipstick, good perfume, just enough to show that I still had my self-respect. In a way, Armenia reminds me of those great Victorian-era British lady travelers who used to say there's no excuse for wearing clothes in Africa that would be unsuited for an English drawing room. She's a butterfly, this Armenia. And she couldn't stay for too long at Moyen's shop because she had work to do, but that didn't stop her from inviting me to a party tonight. She knows another Brazilian expat in Ubud, she told me, and he's hosting a special event at a nice restaurant this evening. He'll be cooking a feijoada, a traditional Brazilian feast consisting of massive piles of pork and black beans. There will be Brazilian cocktails as well. Lots of interesting expatriates from all over the world who live here in Bali. Would I care to come? They might all go out dancing later, too. She doesn't know if I like parties, but... cocktails? Dancing? Piles of pork? Of course I'll come. 89. I can't remember the last time I got dressed up, but this evening I dug out my one fancy spaghetti strap dress from the bottom of my backpack and slithered it on. I even wore lipstick. I can't remember the last time I wore lipstick, but I know it wasn't anywhere near India. I stopped at Armenia's house on the way over to the party, and she draped me in some of her fancy jewelry, let me borrow her fancy perfume, let me store my bicycle in her backyard so I could arrive at the party in her fancy car, like a proper adult woman. The dinner with the expatriates was great fun, and I felt myself revisiting all these long dormant aspects of my personality. I even got a little bit drunk, which was notable after the purity of my last months of praying at the ashram and sipping tea in my Balinese flower garden. And I was flirting. I hadn't flirted in ages. I'd only been hanging around with monks and medicine men lately, but suddenly I was dusting off all the old sexuality again. Though I couldn't really tell who I was flirting with, I was kind of spreading it around everywhere. Was I attracted to the witty Australian former journalist sitting next to me? "We're all drunks here," he quipped. "We write references for other drunks." Or was it the quiet, intellectual German down the table? He promised to lend me novels from his personal library. Or was it the handsome older Brazilian man who had cooked this giant feast for all of us in the first place? I liked his kind brown eyes and his accent and his cooking, of course. I said something very provocative to him out of nowhere. He was making a joke at his own expense, saying, "I'm a full catastrophe of a Brazilian man. I can't dance, I can't play soccer, and I can't play any musical instruments." For some reason, I replied, "Maybe so, but I have a feeling you could play a very good Casanova." Time stopped solid for a long, long moment then, as we looked at each other frankly like, that was an interesting idea to lay on this table. The boldness of my statement hovered in the air around us like a fragrance. He didn't deny it. I looked away first, feeling myself blush. His feijoada was amazing anyway, decadent, spicy, and rich, everything you can't normally get in Balinese food. I ate plate after plate of the pork and decided that it was official. I can never be a vegetarian, not with food like this in the world. And then we went out dancing at this local nightclub, if you can call it a nightclub. It was more like a groovy beach shack, only without the beach. There was a live band of Balinese kids playing good reggae music, and the place was mixed up with revelers of all ages and nationalities, expats and tourists and locals and gorgeous Balinese boys and girls, all dancing freely, unselfconsciously. Armenia hadn't come along, claiming she had to work the next day, but the handsome older Brazilian man was my host. He wasn't such a bad dancer as he claimed. Probably he can play soccer, too. I liked having him nearby, opening doors for me, complimenting me, calling me darling. Then again, I noticed that he called everyone darling, even the hairy male bartender. Still, the attention was nice. It had been so long since I'd been in a bar. Even in Italy, I didn't go to bars, and I hadn't been out much during the David years either. I think the last time I'd gone dancing was back when I was married, back when I was happily married, come to think of it. Dear God, it had been ages. Out on the dance floor, I ran into my friend Stefania, a lively young Italian girl I'd met recently in a meditation class in Ubud, and we danced together, hair flying everywhere, blonde and dark, spinning merrily around. Sometime after midnight, the band stopped playing, and people mingled, and that's when I met the guy named Ian. Oh, I really liked this guy. Right away, I really liked him. He was very good-looking, in a kind of Sting meets Ralph Fiennes his younger brother sort of way. He was Welsh, so he had that lovely voice. He was articulate, smart, asked questions, spoke to my friend Stefania in the same baby Italian that I speak. It turned out that he was the drummer in this reggae band, that he played bongos. So I made a joke that he was a bongolier, kind of like those guys in Venice, but with percussion instead of boats, and somehow we hit it off, started laughing and talking. Felipe came over then. That was the Brazilian's name, Felipe. He invited us all to go out to this funky local restaurant owned by European expatriates, a wildly permissive place that never closes, he promised, where beer and bullshit are served at all hours. I found myself looking to Ian. Did he want to go? And when he said yes, I said yes also. So we all went to the restaurant, and I sat with Ian, and we talked and joked all night, and oh, I really liked this guy. He was the first man I'd met in a long while who I really liked in that way, as they say. He was a few years older than me, had led a most interesting life with all the good resume points, liked The Simpsons, traveled all over the world, lived in an ashram once, mentioned Tolstoy, seemed to be employed, etc. He'd started his career in the British Army in Northern Ireland as a bomb squad expert, then became an international minefield detonation guy, built refugee camps in Bosnia, was now taking a break in Bali to work on music, all very alluring stuff. I could not believe I was still up at 3:30 a.m., and not to meditate, either. I was up in the middle of the night and wearing a dress and talking to an attractive man. How terribly radical. At the end of the evening, Ian and I admitted to each other how nice it had been to meet. He asked if I had a phone number, and I told him I didn't, but that I did have email, and he said, "Yeah, but email just feels so, eh." So at the end of the night, we didn't exchange anything but a hug. He said, "We'll see each other again when they," pointing up to the gods in the sky, "say so." Just before dawn, Felipe, the handsome older Brazilian man, offered me a ride home. As we rode up the twisting back roads, he said, "Darling, you've been talking to the biggest bullshitter in Ubud all night long." My heart sank. "Is Ian really a bullshitter?" I asked. "Tell me the truth now and save me the trouble later." "Ian," said Felipe. He laughed. "No, darling, Ian is a serious guy. He's a good man. I meant myself. I'm the biggest bullshitter in Ubud." We rode along in silence for a while. "And I'm just teasing anyway," he added. Then another long silence, and he asked, "You like Ian, don't you?" "I don't know," I said. My head wasn't clear. I'd been drinking too many Brazilian cocktails. "He's attractive, intelligent. It's been a long time since I thought about liking anybody." "You're going to have a wonderful few months here in Bali. You wait and see," Felipe said. "But I don't know how much more socializing I can do, Felipe. I only have the one dress. People will start to notice that I'm wearing the same thing all the time." "You're young and beautiful, darling. You only need the one dress." 90. Am I young and beautiful? I thought I was old and divorced. I can barely sleep at all this night, so unaccustomed to these odd hours, the dance music still thrumming in my head, my hair smelling of cigarettes, my stomach protesting the alcohol. I doze a bit, then wake as the sun comes up, just as I am accustomed to. Only this morning, I am not rested, and I am not at peace, and I'm in no condition whatsoever for meditation. Why am I so agitated? I'd had a nice night, didn't I? I got to meet some interesting people, got to dress up and dance around, had flirted with some men. Men. The agitation gets more jagged at the thought of that word, turning into a minor panic assailment. I don't know how to do this anymore. I used to be the biggest and boldest and most shameless of flirts when I was in my teens and twenties. I seem to remember that it was once fun, meeting some guy, spooling him in toward me, spooning out the veiled invitations and the provocations, casting aside all caution and letting the consequences spill how they will. But now, I am feeling only panic and uncertainty. I start blowing the whole evening up into something much huger than it was, imagining myself getting involved with this Welsh guy who hadn't even given me an email address. I can see all the way into our future together, including the arguments over his smoking habit. I wonder if giving myself to a man again will ruin my journey, writing, life, etc. On the other hand, some romance would be nice. It's been a long, dry time. I remember Richard from Texas advising me at one point, vis-a-vis my love life, "You need a drought breaker, baby. Got to go find yourself a rainmaker." Then I imagine Ian zooming over on his motorbike with his handsome bomb squad torso to make love to me in my garden, and how nice that would be. This not entirely unpleasant thought somehow screeches me, however, into a horrible skid about how I just don't want to go through any heartbreak again. Then I start to miss David more than I have in months, thinking, maybe I should call him, see if he wants to try getting together again. Then I receive a very accurate channeling of my old friend Richard saying, "Oh, that's genius, groceries. Did you get a lobotomy last night in addition to getting a little tipsy?" It's never a far leap from ruminating about David to obsessing about the circumstances of my divorce, and so soon I start brooding, just like old times, about my ex-husband, my divorce. I thought we were done with this topic, groceries. And then I start thinking about Felipe, for some reason, that handsome older Brazilian man. He's nice. Felipe. He says I am young and beautiful, and that I will have a wonderful time here in Bali. He's right, right? I should relax and have some fun, right? But this morning, it doesn't feel fun. I don't know how to do this anymore. 91. What is this life? Do you understand? I don't. This was Wyann talking. I was back in her restaurant, eating her delicious and nutritious multivitamin lunch special, hoping it would help ease my hangover and my anxiety. Armenia, the Brazilian woman, was there, too, looking, as always, like she'd just stopped by the beauty parlor on her way home from a weekend at the spa. Little Tutti was sitting on the floor, drawing pictures of houses, as usual. Wyann had just learned that the lease on her shop was going to come up for renewal at the end of August, only 3 months from now, and that her rent would be raised. She would probably have to move again because she couldn't afford to stay here, except that she only had about $50 in the bank and no idea where to go. Moving would take Tutti out of school again. They needed a home, a real home. This is no way for a Balinese person to live. "Why does suffering never end?" Wyann asked. She wasn't crying, merely posing a simple, unanswerable, and weary question. "Why must everything be repeat and repeat, never finished, never resting? You work so hard one day, but the next day you must only work again. You eat, but the next day you are hungry. You find love, then love go away. You are born with nothing, no watch, no t-shirt. You work hard, then you die with nothing, no watch, no t-shirt. You are young, then you are old. No matter how hard you work, you cannot stop getting old." "Not Armenia," I joked. "She doesn't get old, apparently." Wyann said, "But this is because Armenia is Brazilian," catching on now to how the world works. We all laughed, but it was a fair breed of gallows humor, because there's nothing funny about Wyann's situation in the world right now. Here are the facts. Single mom, precocious child, hand-to-mouth business, imminent poverty, virtual homelessness. Where will she go? Can't live with the ex-husband's family, obviously. Wyann's own family are rice farmers way out in the countryside, and poor. If she goes and lives with them, it's the end of her business as a healer in town, because her patients won't be able to reach her, and you can pretty much forget about Tutti ever getting enough education to go someday to animal doctor college. Other factors have emerged over time. Those two shy girls I noticed on the first day, hiding in the back of the kitchen, it turns out that these are a pair of orphans Wyann has adopted. They are both named Katut, just to further confuse this story, and we call them Big Katut and Little Katut. Wyann found the Katuts starving and begging in the marketplace a few months ago. They were abandoned there by a Dickensian character of a woman, possibly a relative, who acts as a sort of begging child pimp, depositing parentless children in various marketplaces across Bali to beg for money, then picking the kids up every night in a van collecting their proceeds and giving them a shack somewhere in which to sleep. When Wyan first found Big and Little Katut, they hadn't eaten for days, had lice and parasites, the works. She thinks the younger one is maybe 10, and the older one might be 13, but they don't know their own ages, or even their last names. Little Katut knows only that she was born the same year as the big pig in her village. This hasn't helped the rest of us establish a timeline. Wyan has taken them in and cares for them as lovingly as she does her own Tuti. She and the three children all sleep on the same mattress in the one bedroom behind the shop. How a Balinese single mother facing eviction found it in her heart to take in two extra homeless children is something that reaches far beyond any understanding I've ever had about the meaning of compassion. I want to help them. That was it. This is what that trembling feeling was, which I'd experienced so profoundly after meeting Wyan for the first time. I wanted to help this single mother and her daughter and her extra orphans. I wanted to valet park them into a better life. It's just that I hadn't been able to figure out how to do it. But today, as Wyan and Armenia and I were eating our lunch and weaving our typical conversation of empathy and chops busting, I looked over at little Tuti and noticed she was doing something rather odd. She was walking around the shop with a single small square of pretty cobalt blue ceramic tile resting on the palms of her upturned hands, singing in a chanting sort of way. I watched her for a while, just to see what she was up to. Tuti played with that tile for a long time, tossing it in the air, whispering to it, singing to it, then pushing it along the floor like it was a matchbox car. Finally, she sat upon it in a quiet corner, eyes closed, singing to herself, buried in some mystical, invisible compartment of space all her own. I asked Wyan what this was all about. She said that Tuti had found the tile outside the construction site of a fancy hotel project down the road and had pocketed it. Ever since Tuti had found the tile, she kept saying to her mother, "Maybe if we have a house someday, it can have a pretty blue floor like this." Now, according to Wyan, Tuti often likes to sit perched on that one tiny blue square for hours on end, shutting her eyes and pretending she's inside her own house. What can I say? When I heard that story and looked at that child deep in meditation upon her small blue tile, I was like, okay, that does it. And I excused myself from the shop to go take care of this intolerable state of affairs once and for all. 92. Wyan told me once that sometimes when she's healing her patients, she becomes an open pipeline for God's love, and she ceases even thinking about what needs to be done next. The intellect stops, the intuition rises, and all she has to do is permit her godness to flow through her. She says, "It feel like a wind comes and takes my hands." The same wind, maybe, is the thing that blew me out of Wyan's shop that day, that pushed me out of my hungover anxiety about whether I was ready to start dating again, and guided me over to Ubud's local internet cafe, where I sat and wrote, in one effortless draft, a fundraising email to all my friends and family across the world. I told everyone that my birthday was coming up in July, and that soon I would be turning 35. I told them that there was nothing in this world that I needed or wanted, and that I had never been happier in my life. I told them that if I were home in New York, I would be planning a big, stupid birthday party, and I would make them all come to this party, and they would have to buy me gifts and bottles of wine, and the whole celebration would get ridiculously expensive. Therefore, I explained, a cheaper and more lovely way to help celebrate this birthday would be if my friends and family would care to make a donation to help a woman named Wyan Noriasi buy a house in Indonesia for herself and for her children. Then I told the whole story of Wyan and Tuti and the orphans and their situation. I promised that whatever money was donated, I would match the donation from my own savings. Of course, I was aware, I explained, that this is a world full of untold suffering and war, and that everyone is in need right now. But what are we to do? This little group of people in Bali had become my family, and we must take care of our families wherever we find them. As I wrapped up the mass email, I remembered something my friend Susan had said to me before I left on this world journey 9 months ago. She was afraid I would never come home again. She said, "I know how you are, Liz. You're going to meet somebody and fall in love and end up buying a house in Bali." A regular Nostradamus, that Susan. By the next morning, when I checked my email, $700 had already been pledged. The next day, donations passed what I could afford to match. I won't go through the entire drama of the week or try to explain what it feels like to open emails every day from all over the world that all say, "Count me in." Everyone gave. People whom I personally knew to be broke or in debt gave, without hesitation. One of the first responses I got was from a friend of my hairdresser's girlfriend who'd been forwarded the email and who wanted to donate $15. My most wise-ass friend, John, had to make a typically sarcastic comment, of course, about how long and sappy and emotional my letter had been. "Listen, next time you feel the need to cry about spilled milk, make sure it's condensed, will ya?" But then he donated money anyway. My friend Annie's new boyfriend, a Wall Street banker whom I'd never even met, offered to double the final sum of whatever was raised. Then that email started whipping around the world so that I began to receive donations from perfect strangers. It was a global smothering of generosity. Let's just wrap up this episode by saying that, a mere 7 days after the original plea went out over the wires, my friends and my family and a bunch of strangers all over the world helped me come up with almost $18,000 to buy Wayan Nuriasi a house of her own. I knew that it was Tuti who had manifested this miracle through the potency of her prayers, willing that little blue tile of hers to soften and expand around her and grow like one of Jack's magic beans into an actual home that would take care of herself and her mother and a pair of orphans forever. One last thing. I'm embarrassed to admit that it was my friend Bob, not me, who noticed the obvious fact that the word tutti in Italian means everybody. How had I not realized that earlier? After all those months in Rome, I just didn't see the connection. So it was Bob over in Utah who had to point it out to me. He did so in an email last week, saying, along with his pledge to donate toward the new house, "So that's the final lesson, isn't it? When you set out in the world to help yourself, you inevitably end up helping Tuti." 93. I don't want to tell Wayan about it, not until all the money has been raised. It's hard to keep a big secret like this, especially when she's in such constant worry about her future, but I don't want to get her hopes up until it's all official. So for the whole week, I keep my mouth shut about my plans, and I keep myself occupied having dinner almost every night with Felipe the Brazilian, who doesn't seem to mind that I own only one nice dress. I guess I have a crush on him. After a few dinners, I'm fairly certain I have a crush on him. He's more than he appears, this self-proclaimed bullshit master, who knows everyone in Ubud and who is always the center of the party. I asked Armenia about him. They've been friends for a while. I said, "That Felipe, he's got more depth than the others, doesn't he? There's something more to him, isn't there?" She said, "Oh, yes, he's a good, kind man. But he's been through a hard divorce. I think he's come to Bali to recover." Ah, now this is a subject I know nothing about. But he's 52 years old. This is interesting. Have I truly reached the age where a 52-year-old man is within my realm of dating consideration? I like him, though. He's got silver hair, and he's balding in an attractively Picasso-esque manner. His eyes are warm and brown, he has a gentle face, and he smells wonderful. And he is an actual grown man, the adult male of the species, a bit of a novelty in my experience. He's been living in Bali for about 5 years now, working with Balinese silversmiths to make jewelry from Brazilian gemstones for export to America. I like the fact that he was faithfully married for almost 20 years before his marriage deteriorated for its own multi-complicated plethora of reasons. I like the fact that he has already raised children, and that he raised them well, and that they love him. I like that he was the parent who stayed home and tended to his children when they were little, while his Australian wife pursued her career. A good feminist husband, he says, "I wanted to be on the correct side of social history." I like his natural Brazilian over-the-top displays of affection. When his Australian son was 14 years old, the boy finally had to say, Dad, now that I'm 14, maybe you shouldn't kiss me on the mouth anymore when you drop me off at school. I like the fact that Felipe speaks 4, maybe more, languages fluently. He keeps claiming he doesn't speak Indonesian, but I hear him talking it all day long. I like that he's traveled through over 50 countries in his life and that he sees the world as a small and easily managed place. I like the way he listens to me, leaning in, interrupting me only when I interrupt myself to ask if I am boring him, to which he always responds, "I have all the time in the world for you, my lovely little darling." I like being called my lovely little darling, even if the waitress gets it too. He said to me the other night, "Why don't you take a lover while you're in Bali, Liz?" To his credit, he didn't just mean himself, though I believe he might be willing to take on the job. He assured me that Ian, that good-looking Welsh guy, would be a fine match for me. But there are other candidates, too. There's a chef from New York City, a great big muscular, confident fellow, whom he thinks I might like. "Really, there are all sorts of men here," he said, "all of them floating through Ubud, expatriates from everywhere, hiding out in this shifting community of the planet's homeless and assetless, many of whom would be happy to see to it, my lovely little darling, that you have a wonderful summer here." "I don't think I'm ready for it," I told him. "I don't feel like going through all the efforts of romance again, you know? I don't feel like having to shave my legs every day or having to show my body to a new lover. And I don't want to have to tell my life story all over again or worry about birth control. Anyway, I'm not even sure I know how to do it anymore. I feel like I was more confident about sex and romance when I was 16 than I am now." "Of course you were," Felipe said. "You were young and stupid then. Only the young and stupid are confident about sex and romance. Do you think any of us know what we're doing? Do you think there's any way humans can love each other without complication? You should see how it happens in Bali, darling. All these Western men come here after they've made a mess of their lives back home, and they decide they've had it with Western women, and they go marry some tiny, sweet, obedient little Balinese teenage girl. I know what they're thinking. They think this pretty little girl will make them happy, make their lives easy. But whenever I see it happen, I always want to say the same thing. Good luck. Because you still have a woman in front of you, my friend, and you are still a man. It is still two human beings trying to get along, so it's going to become complicated. And love is always complicated. But still, humans must try to love each other, darling. We must get our hearts broken sometimes. This is a good sign, having a broken heart. It means we have tried for something." I said, "My heart was broken so badly last time that it still hurts. Isn't that crazy? To still have a broken heart almost 2 years after a love story ends?" "Darling, I'm Southern Brazilian. I can keep a broken heart going for 10 years over a woman I never even kissed." We talk about our marriages, our divorces, not in a petty way, but just to commiserate. We compare notes about the bottomless depths of post-divorce depression. We drink wine and eat well together, and we tell each other the nicest stories we can remember about our former spouses, just to take the sting out of all that conversation about loss. He says, "Do you want to do something with me this weekend?" And I find myself saying, "Yes, that would be nice." Because it would be nice. Twice now, dropping me off in front of my house and saying goodnight, Felipe has reached across the car to give me a goodnight kiss, and twice now I've done the same thing, allowing myself to be pulled into him, but then ducking my head at the last moment and tucking my cheek up against his chest. There, I let him hold me for a little while, longer than is necessarily merely friendly. I can feel him press his face into my hair as my face presses somewhere against his sternum. I can smell his soft linen shirt. I really like the way he smells. He has muscular arms, a nice wide chest. He was once a champion gymnast back in Brazil. Of course, that was in 1969, which was the year I was born. But still, his body feels strong. My ducking my head like this whenever he reaches for me is a kind of hiding. I'm avoiding a simple goodnight kiss. But it's also a kind of not hiding, too. By letting him hold me at all during those long quiet moments at the end of the evening, I'm letting myself be held, which hasn't happened for a long time. 94. I asked Katut, my old medicine man, "What do you know about romance?" He said, "What is this romance?" "Never mind," I said. know what it is, what this word means. Romance, I defined. Women and men in love, or sometimes men and men in love, or women and women in love. Kissing and sex and marriage, all that stuff. I not make sex with too many people in my life, Liz. Only with my wife. You're right, that's not too many people. But do you mean your first wife or your second wife? I only have one wife, Liz. She dead now. But what about Nyomo? Nyomo not really my wife, Liz. She is the wife of my brother. Seeing my confused expression, he added, "This typical Bali," and explained. Katut's older brother, who is a rice farmer, lives next door to Katut and is married to Nyomo. They had three children together. Katut and his wife, on the other hand, were unable to have any children at all, so they adopted one of Katut's brother's sons in order to have an heir. When Katut's wife died, Nyomo began living in both family compounds, splitting her time between the two households, taking care of both her husband and his brother, and tending to the two families of her children. She is in every way a wife to Katut in the Balinese manner, cooking, cleaning, taking care of household religious ceremonies and rituals, except that they don't have sex together. Why not? I asked. Too old, he said. Then he called Nyomo over to relay the question to her, to let her know that the American lady wants to know why they don't have sex with each other. Nyomo about died laughing at the very thought of it. She came over and punched me on the arm hard. I only had one wife, Katut went on, and now she dead. Do you miss her? A sad smile. It was her time to die. Now I tell you how I find my wife. When I am 27 years old, I meet a girl and I love her. What year was that? I asked, desperate as always to figure out how old he is. I don't know, he said. Maybe 1920? Which would make him about 112 by now. I think we're getting closer to solving this. I love this girl, Liz. Very beautiful, but not good character, this girl. She only want money. She chase other boys. She never tell truth. I think she had a secret mind inside her other mind. Nobody can see inside there. She stopped to loving me, go away with other boy. I am very sad, broken in my heart. I pray and pray to my four spirit brothers, ask, why is she not love me anymore? Then one of my spirit brothers, he tell me the truth. He say, this is not your true match. Be patient. So I be patient, and then I find my wife. Beautiful woman, good woman, always sweet to me. Never once we argue, have always harmony in household, always she smiling. Even when no money at home, always she smiling and saying how happy she is to see me. When she die, I very sad in my mind. Did you cry? I asked. Only little bit in my eyes. But I do meditation to clean the body from pain. I meditate for her soul. Very sad, but happy too. I visit her in meditation every day, even to kissing her. She the only woman I ever make sex with, so I do not know. What is new word from today? Romance? Yes, romance. I do not know romance, Liz.
So it's not really your area of expertise, eh?
What is this, expertise? What this word means?
95. I finally sat down with Wyann and told her about the money I'd raised for her house. I explained about my birthday wish, showed her the list of all my friends' names, and then told her the final amount which had been raised, $18,000. At first, she was shocked to such an extent that her face looked like a mask of grief. It is strange and true that sometimes intense emotion can cause us to respond to cataclysmic news in exactly the opposite manner logic might dictate. This is the absolute value of human emotion. Joyful events can sometimes register on the Richter scale as pure trauma. Dreadful grief makes us sometimes burst out laughing. This news I had just handed to Wyann was too much for her to take in. She almost received it as a cause for sorrow. So I sat there with her for a few hours, telling her the story repeatedly and showing her the numbers again and again until the reality began to sink in. Her first really articulate response, I mean, even before she burst into tears because she realized she was going to be able to have a garden, was to urgently say, Please, Liz, you must explain to everyone who helped raise money that this is not Wyann's house. This is the house of everyone who helped Wyann. If any of these people comes to Bali, they must never stay in a hotel, okay? You tell them they come and stay at my house, okay? Promise to tell them that. We call it the group house, the house for everybody. Then she realized about the garden and started to cry. Slowly, though, happier realizations come to her. It was like she was a pocketbook shaken upside down and emotions were spilling all over the place. If she had a home, she could have a small library for all her medical books and a pharmacy for her traditional remedies and a proper restaurant with real chairs and tables because she had to sell all her old good chairs and tables to pay the divorce lawyer. If she had a home, she could finally be listed in Lonely Planet, who keep wanting to mention her services but never can do so because she never has a permanent address that they can print. If she had a home, Tuti could have a birthday party someday. Then she got very sober and serious again. How can I thank you, Liz? I would give you anything. If I had husband I loved and you needed a man, I would give you my husband. Keep your husband, Wyann. Just make sure Tuti goes to university. But what would I do if you never came here? But I was always coming here. I thought about one of my favorite Sufi poems, which says that God long ago drew a circle in the sand exactly around the spot where you are standing right now. I was never not coming here. This was never not going to happen. Where are you going to build your new house, Wyann? I asked. Like a little leaguer who's had his eye on a certain baseball glove in the shop window for ages, or a romantic girl who's been designing her wedding dress since she was 13, it turned out that Wyann already knew exactly the piece of land she would like to buy. It was in the center of a nearby village, was connected to municipal water and electricity, had a good school nearby for Tuti, was nicely located in a central place where her patients and customers could find her on foot. Her brothers could help her build the home, she said. She'd all but picked out the paint chips for the master bedroom already. So we went together to visit a nice French expatriate financial advisor and real estate guy who was kind enough to suggest the best way to transfer the money. His suggestion was that I keep it easy and just wire the money directly from my bank account into Wyann's bank account and let her buy whatever land or home she wants to so I don't have to mess around with owning property in Indonesia. As long as I didn't wire over amounts bigger than $10,000 at a time, the IRS and the CIA wouldn't suspect me of laundering drug money. Then we went to Wyann's little bank and talked to the manager about how to set up a wire transfer. In neat conclusion, the bank manager said, "So, Wyann, when this wire transfer goes through in just a few days, you should have about 180 million rupiah in your bank account." Wyann and I looked at each other and sparked off into a ridiculous riot of laughter. Such an enormous sum! We kept trying to pull ourselves together since we were in some fancy banker's office, but we couldn't stop laughing. We stumbled out of there like drunks, holding on to each other to not fall over. She said, "Never have I seen a miracle happen so fast. All this time I was begging to God to please help Wyann, and God was begging to Liz to please help Wyann too." I added, "And Liz was begging her friends to please help Wyann too." We returned to the shop, found Tuti just home from school. Wyann dropped to her knees, grabbed her little girl, and said, "A house! A house! We have a house!" Tuti executed a fabulous fake faint, swooning cartoonishly right to the floor. While we were all laughing, I noticed the two orphans watching this scene from the background of the kitchen, and I could see them looking at me with something in their faces that resembled fear. As Wyann and Tuti galloped around in joy, I wondered what the orphans were thinking. What were they so afraid of? Being left behind, maybe? Or was I now a scary person to them because I'd produced so much money out of nowhere, such an unthinkable amount of money, that maybe it's like black magic? Or maybe, when you've had such a fragile life as these kids, any change is a terror. When there was a lull in the celebration, I asked Wyann, just to be sure, "What about Big Katut and Little Katut? Is this good news for them, too?" Wyann looked over at the girls in the kitchen and must have seen the same uneasiness I had seen, because she floated over to them and herded them into her arms and whispered some reassuring words into the crowns of their heads. They seemed to relax into her. Then the phone rang, and Wyann tried to pull away from the orphans to answer it, but the skinny arms of the two katuts clung onto their unofficial mother relentlessly, and they buried their heads in her belly and armpits, and even after the longest time they refused, with a fierceness I'd never before seen in them, to let her go. So I answered the phone instead.
"Balinese traditional healing," I said. "Stop by today for our giant closeout moving sale."
96. I went out with Brazilian Felipe again, twice over the weekend. On Saturday, I brought him to meet Wyan and the kids, and Tuti made drawings of houses for him, while Wyan winked suggestively behind his back and mouthed, "New boyfriend?" And I kept shaking my head, "No, no, no." Though I'll tell you what, I'm not thinking about that cute Welsh guy anymore. I also brought Felipe to meet Katut, my medicine man, and Katut read his palm and pronounced my friend no fewer than 7 times, while fixing me with a penetrating stare, to be a good man, a very good man, a very, very good man. Not a bad man, Liz, a good man. Then on Sunday, Felipe asked me if I'd like to spend a day at the beach. It occurred to me that I'd been living here in Bali for 2 months already and had not yet seen the beach, which now seemed like sheer idiocy, so I said yes. He picked me up at my house in his jeep, and we drove an hour to this hidden little beach in Padang Bay, where hardly any tourists ever go. This place that he took me to, it was as good an imitation of paradise as anything I'd ever seen, with blue water and white sand and the shade of palm trees. We talked all day, interrupting our talking only to swim and nap and read, sometimes reading aloud to each other. These Balinese women in a shack behind the beach grilled us freshly caught fish, and we bought cold beers and chilled fruit. Dallying in the waves, we told each other whatever was left of the life story details which we hadn't yet covered in the past few weeks of spending evenings together out in the quietest restaurants in Ubud, talking over bottles and bottles of wine. He liked my body, he told me, after the initial viewing at the beach. He told me that Brazilians have a term for exactly my kind of body. Of course they do. Which is magra falsa, meaning fake thin. Meaning that the woman looks slender enough from a distance, but when you get up close, you can see that she's actually quite round and fleshy, which Brazilians consider a good thing. God bless Brazilians. As we lay on our towels talking, he would reach over sometimes and brush sand off my nose or push a mutinying hair out of my face. We talked for about 10 solid hours. Then it was dark, so we packed up our things and went for a walk through the not very well-lit dirt road main street of this old Balinese fishing village, linked comfortably arm in arm under the stars. That's when Felipe from Brazil asked me in the most natural and relaxed of ways, almost as if he were wondering if we should get a bite to eat, "Should we have an affair together, Liz? What do you think?" I liked everything about the way this was happening, not with an action, not with an attempted kiss or a daring move, but with a question. And the correct question, too. I remembered something my therapist had said to me over a year ago before I left on this journey. I'd told her that I thought I wanted to remain celibate for this whole year of traveling, but worried, what if I meet somebody I really like? What should I do? Should I get together with him or not? Should I maintain my autonomy or treat myself to a romance? My therapist replied with an indulgent smile, "You know, Liz, all of this can be discussed at the time the issue actually arises, with the person in question." So here it all was, the time, the place, the issue, and the person in question. We proceeded to have a discussion about the idea, which came out easily during our friendly, linked, arm-in-arm walk by the ocean. I said, "I would probably say yes, Felipe, under normal circumstances, whatever normal circumstances are." We both laughed, but then I showed him my hesitation, which was this: that as much as I might enjoy to have my body and heart folded and unfolded for a while in the expert hands of an expat lover, something else inside me has put in a serious request that I donate the entirety of this year of traveling all to myself, that some vital transformation is happening in my life, and this transformation needs time and room in order to finish its process undisturbed, that basically I'm the cake that just came out of the oven and still needs some more time to cool before it can be frosted. I don't want to cheat myself out of this precious time. I don't want to lose control of my life again. Of course, Felipe said that he understood, and that I should do whatever was best for me, and that he hoped I would forgive him for bringing up the question in the first place. It had to be asked, my lovely darling, sooner or later. He assured me that, whatever I decided, we would still keep our friendship, since it seemed to be so good for both of us all this time we were spending together. Although, he went on, you do need to let me make my case now. Fair enough, I said. For one thing, if I understand you correctly, this whole year is about your search for balance between devotion and pleasure. I can see where you've been doing a lot of devotional practices, but I'm not sure where the pleasure has come in so far. I ate a lot of pasta in Italy, Felipe. Pasta, Liz? Pasta? Good point. For another thing, I think I know what you're worried about. Some man is going to come into your life and take everything from you again. I won't do that to you, darling. I've been alone for a long time, too, and I've lost a great deal in love just like you have. I don't want us to take anything from each other. It's just that I never enjoyed anyone's company as much as I enjoy yours, and I'd like to be with you. Don't worry, I'm not going to chase you back to New York when you leave here in September. And as for all those reasons you told me a few weeks ago that you didn't want to take a lover, well, think of it this way. I don't care if you shave your legs every day. I already love your body. You've already told me your entire life story. And you don't have to worry about birth control. I've had a vasectomy. Felipe, I said, that's the most appealing and romantic offer a man has ever made to me. And it was. But still, I said no. He drove me home. Parked in front of my house, we shared a few sweet, salty, sandy, day-at-the-ocean kisses. It was lovely. Of course it was lovely. But still, and again, I said no. That's fine, darling, he said. But come to my house tomorrow night for dinner, and I'll make you a steak. Then he drove off, and I went to bed alone. I have a history of making decisions very quickly about men. I have always fallen in love fast and without measuring risks. I have a tendency not only to see the best in everyone, but to assume that everyone is emotionally capable of reaching his highest potential. I have fallen in love more times than I care to count with the highest potential of a man, rather than with the man himself, and that I have hung on to the relationship for a long time, sometimes far too long, waiting for the man to ascend to his own greatness. Many times in romance, I have been a victim of my own optimism. I married young and quick, from a place of love and hope, but without a lot of discussion over what the realities of marriage might mean. Nobody advised me on my marriage. I had been raised by my parents to be independent, self-providing, self-deciding. By the time I reached the age of 24, it was assumed by everyone that I could make all my own choices, autonomously. Of course, the world was not always like this. If I'd been born during any other century of Western patriarchy, I would have been considered the property of my father, until which time he passed me over to my husband, to become marital property. I would have had precious little say in the major matters of my own life. At one time in history, if a man had been my suitor, my father might have sat that man down with a long list of questions to establish whether this would be an appropriate match. He would have wanted to know, how will you provide for my daughter? What is your reputation in this community? How is your health? Where will you take her to live? What are your debts and your assets? What are the strengths of your character? My father would have not just given me away in marriage to anybody for the mere fact that I was in love with the fellow. But in modern life, when I made the decision to marry, my modern father didn't become involved at all. He would have no more interfered with that decision than he would have told me how to style my hair. I have no nostalgia for the patriarchy, please believe me. But what I have come to realize is that when that patriarchic system was rightfully dismantled, it was not necessarily replaced by another form of protection. What I mean is, I never thought to ask a suitor the same challenging questions my father might have asked him in a different age. I have given myself away in love many times, merely for the sake of love, and I've given away the farm sometimes in that process. If I am truly to become an autonomous woman, then I must take over that role of being my own guardian. Famously, Gloria Steinem once advised women that they should strive to become like the men they had always wanted to marry. What I've only recently realized is that I not only have to become my own husband, but I need to be my own father, too. And this is why I sent myself to bed that night alone, because I felt it was too soon for me to be receiving a gentleman suitor. That said, I woke up at 2 a.m. with a heavy sigh and a physical hunger so deep I didn't have any idea of how to satisfy it. The lunatic cat who lives in my house was howling mournfully for some reason, and I told him, "I know exactly."